This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Annie Dillard won a Pulitzer Prize in 1975 at the age of 29 for her first book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. The book has been described both as a nature study and a series of poetic religious essays. She wrote this meditative book while living near a creek in a valley in Virginia's Blue Ridge Mountains. She said, "I am no scientist. I explore the neighborhood to view the landscape, to discover at least where it is that we have been so startlingly set down if we can't learn why." She's since written books about her childhood and the process of writing. Now Dillard has written her first novel. It's called The Living, and it's about the pioneers who settled the Northwest frontier. Here's a reading from the opening.
The sailor put down the helm, and Ada Fishburne felt the boat round up towards the forest. She stood in the bow, a supple young woman wearing a brown shawl and a deep-brimmed sunbonnet that circled her face. She carried her infant son, Glee, in her arms. Without a sound, the schooner slipped alongside a sort of dock that met the water from the beach. This dock represented the settlement on Bellingham Bay. Ada Fishburne had been sailing in Puget Sound and along this unbroken forest every day for almost a week. The same forest grew on the islands they passed, too. The trunks rose straight. She had seen enough of this wall of forest to know that even when the sun and all the sky shone full upon it, and the blinding sea glinted up at it, it was always dark. From behind her on deck, Ada heard her older son, Claire, singing a song. Claire was 5, a right big boy for 5, long in the leg bones like his father, and life suited him very well, and he found his enjoyment. She glanced back and saw her husband, Rooney, moving their 4 barrels, their 5 crates, their 4 kegs, and the rolled feather bed to the rail. Young Claire climbed up on everything barefoot as fast as Rooney set it down on the deck. Rooney tied the 2 cows and gave the ropes to Claire to hold, and the boy sang to them, half dead as they were. Neither man nor boy glanced up to see where he was getting off, which was a mercy, one of few, for she herself scarcely minded where she was since she lost her boy Charlie on the overland road, but she hated to see Rooney downhearted when he had staked his blessed being on this place and look at it. Ada and Rooney hauled their possessions off the dock. The baby Glee stayed asleep, moving its lips, and missed the whole thing. The schooner sailed on north and left them there.
Annie Dillard, this is your first novel. What came over you to write a novel?
It just come over me, Al. I'd written a short story in 1977 about just these same people, 2 men, Puget Sound, a threat of death, the big forest. And it interested me more than anything I'd ever written, and I'd always wanted to go back to it and, as it were, flesh it out a bit. And I fleshed it out to the tune of 600-some pages.
When you say go back to it, I mean, you're literally going back not only to that story, but back in time. What interests you about setting a story in the past, about writing about a time that is not your own time?
I don't find these times very interesting. I'd just soon be in the 19th century.
Why?
People read more.
Well, I'm sure you still read a lot anyways. I doubt the century is holding you back from reading. What are the other reasons why you just don't live in the 19th century?
Well, I do like the antibiotics, but popular culture doesn't much interest me. And so to avoid popular culture in what you write, you either have to go back or you have to go in very, very, very deep or ignore it. And I have to live in the modern world, which is quite enough of it for me. So in my imaginative life, I just as soon check out.
So did you feel you had to find a language of the past? I mean, I find your language to be not a contemporary language in this book.
What a wonderful question. That was the most fun about writing the whole thing. I deliberately read no book that was written after, at the beginning, 1855, and then as I went on, 1893, the 1880s, while I was writing about that, in order to try to keep my language completely pure without any possible trace of anachronism. And And, of course, picked up phrases right and left from everything that I was reading, all sorts of little subtle things. For instance, in the 19th century, you would never say a group of people. You would always say a company of people. And a beautiful woman was called striking. They rarely used the word beautiful. And her bosom, essentially, was called her throat. What a beautiful throat this woman has.
Meaning, was that what throat used to
mean? Yeah, meaning, boy, does she look good in that low-cut dress. Uh-huh. But after a while, I developed a kind of sense for what I needed to look up. So I wrote, of course, with a number of reference books all around me. And at one point I thought, I wonder if I can use camouflage as a verb, writing about the 19th century. And I looked up camouflage, and come to find out, you can't use camouflage, period, not as a verb or as a noun, until World War I. It came about in France in World War I.
The characters in your novel, The Living, are settlers. Could you imagine life as a settler yourself? Do you think you would have liked it?
Essentially, in some ways, I lived the life of a settler for parts of four or five years, on an island in Puget Sound, because we had not only no electricity, which is nothing, and no running water, which also proves to be nothing. I thought this would be terribly difficult, but in fact, you spend much less time on the fussing in life than you do when you have those things. But above all, we had no telephone or even radio link with the mainland. There was no link at all. They invited me to the Carter. There was no link at all except the mailboat, which came three times a week on the other side of the island, which was an hour and a half walk across pastures. They invited me to speak at Carter's inauguration. And by the time I got the boat in the water, when I next needed to go to the next land over and get milk for the children, and could get to a phone, by that time I almost was tempted to say, what inauguration? It was all so far away, so terribly far away.
And you liked that?
I liked it just fine. It got awfully dull. We used to, one fellow there got the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times, and would have a party every Sunday morning, and we'd have shirred eggs, which he baked on his wood stove, and little drinks, and we would read the Sunday New York Times, only none of us ever mentioned that it was last Sunday's New York Times, which had come in the mail on the Friday before.
But it didn't matter, because it was also far away anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Annie Dillard. In your book, The Writing Life, you wrote that the life of the writer is colorless to the point of sensory deprivation. This explains why so many books describe the author's childhood. A writer's childhood may well have been the occasion of his only firsthand experience. Did you feel that way about your own life when you were writing about writing?
Yeah. I had written a memoir that ended when I was 17, and my publisher said, well, why don't you write the next stage of it? And the reason is because I didn't do anything except sit in a room for the next 20 years messing up little pieces of paper.
So, and now do you feel like you have more of a life?
Oh, no. No, I really wasn't interested in having life. I finished my book, and I really don't know what to do with myself, and I'm trying real life and finding it wanting. It doesn't seem to add up. Every day just passes and is gone. But when you're writing, every day is another two pages, and that adds up to something, crummy as those may be. On the other hand, there's a sort of selfish, solipsistic absorption to it, which is wearying. And so as soon as you finish writing a book, you want to go rushing out and save the world and help people and stuff.
I was wondering how being a mother affected your sense of not having any firsthand experience because you're always in a room writing.
Yeah, there's enough of that. There's enough of that every day. No, I would write only 3 or 4 hours a day.
But, I mean, has being a mother changed your relationship to everyday life? You're kind of like forced to take part in it when you have a young child.
Yeah, it makes you more normal. On the other hand, I've been a mother for a heck of a long time because my youngest stepkid is 22 now, and I got her when she was 7.
Oh, I see. Let me ask you about your childhood. You were born in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Affluent family. Your family owned American Standard?
Oh, my parents didn't, no, but
your great-great-great-grandfather
or something founded it, yes.
And what was the company?
Yeah, American Standard.
I mean, what did they do?
Brass plumbing and fitting, it started out, and then it became just regular old plumbing. They've been involved in price-fixing scandals steadily ever since with Crane and the other major plumbing companies. It's a totally corrupt industry, as far as I can tell.
So was your father in the business?
Yep.
And were you interested in business when you were growing up?
No, neither was he. He quit and went down the Mississippi by himself in a boat and then fooled around being an actor and making radio spots and so forth for the rest of his life. He was not interested in it at all. He was a great romantic and still is.
So there was enough family money that he didn't feel he needed a job, a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah, I guess you finally hit what's too personal. Family money, for Christ's sake. That's really no subject for conversation. He worked 9-to-5.
Oh, I was thinking when he was traveling down a raft in the Mississippi or whatever you said, was not working 9-to-5.
Right. No, you're right. He took a few months off.
Okay. As a teenager, you wrote your minister a letter saying that you were quitting the church. What did the letter say?
Gosh, I have no idea. It was probably pretty bold.
Why did you quit?
Oh, it was a Presbyterian church in Pittsburgh, and I was a kid, and I thought I knew the Bible well enough to damn these people to hell, chapter and verse. Here they were in their minks and so forth. And they were the owners of, you know, of Pittsburgh industry and old money and banks and so forth. And I thought I was morally superior to these people, who, it turned out, of course, I realized as I grew up, had suffered enormously and had their private lives and had their private relation with God, and I knew nothing about it whatsoever.
Now, your father said to you, and you write about this in your memoir, your father said to you, didn't you realize that some people did these kinds of things quietly, no fuss? He thought you were trying to humiliate your parents by taking this grand gesture by writing the letter and giving it to the minister.
I was a trial to those people. Yeah, I also got in a drag race and got myself fingerprinted and on the front page of the paper and all that. Yeah, I was a constant trial to these people who were trying to live fairly discreetly.
Oh, right. And you were rebellious?
You bet.
Now, you later described yourself as a wanderer with a background in theology and a penchant for quirky facts. What is your background in theology?
Oh, I took a lot of theology at college, quite a lot. And then when I finished college, I was married, living in Virginia and not doing a daggone thing except playing pinochle and softball all the time. And so I set about trying to educate myself. And one of the fields in which I read was theology.
Do you think of yourself as a religious person?
You bet.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I converted to Catholicism 2 years ago.
For example. Right. Have you found a church where you live that you like a lot?
I like a church on a college campus where you can go in your blue jeans and take communion and get out of there in 20 minutes. But what I really like best is a church where you're traveling, where you can go into some place in Tahiti or Greenland or something and just be anonymous.
What do you like about the anonymity?
Well, otherwise it becomes just another social meeting. But when you're anonymous, you're just a person standing for people, praying to your God.
Mm-hmm.
The prayer of all the people. What the hell is going on? Whatever your prayer is, you're representing the people.
You got married for the first time at the end of your sophomore year in college, which, I don't know, strikes me as pretty young, though.
It's okay. Struggle not. No, this doesn't bother me at all.
Okay.
Anything but money.
You got married at the end of your sophomore year in college, and I think the man that you married was a teacher of yours.
That's right, Richard Dillard.
Was he an English teacher?
You bet.
That strikes me as a kind of problematic, challenging thing to do, because when you marry someone, you want to feel like you have a fairly equal relationship. But when you start off in a relationship where one person's the teacher and one person's the student, is it hard to overcome that in the personal part of your life?
No, it was no problem at all. I loved what he had to teach me. And he didn't know anything about women.
So you could teach him about that.
That's right.
Were your parents upset that you got married before you finished college?
No, because I continued to finish college.
Oh, you stayed in school?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And then I went on and got a master's and so forth, worked for the poverty program. No, it didn't interrupt my education at all. In fact, it enhanced it enormously. Because it turns out when you get married, you have absolutely nothing to do. All your friends are busy staying up all night, having a good time, and dating boys, and you're doing none of those things. So you're just doing your work like a good girl, and you do very well.
In your book, The Writing Life, you wrote that the fanaticism of your 20s shocks you now. What were the symptoms of your fanaticism when you were in your 20s?
Oh, gee. I thought that in order to to save myself for literature, there were a number of things in which I could not engage. Entertaining, dressing, combing my hair. On the other hand, I could play all sorts of softball and pinochle and so forth, and go dancing and tell jokes and play chess and play anagrams and so forth. But I was determined not to become a lady because I saw that becoming lady was the big trap. Becoming a lady was the big trap.
Huh. What did becoming a lady mean? How did you define that?
Being well-groomed with good clothes in a beautiful house.
So this is like your mother's version of becoming a lady.
I wouldn't blame her for that. I was young.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But so, I guess what I'm trying to figure out if it was growing up that you wanted to resist, or a certain version of being a lady that you wanted to resist.
Both of those things, and I still want to resist growing up. I've been a grown up now for some time, and I don't find anything in it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Annie Dillard. She has a new novel called The Living, and her other books include An American Childhood, The Writing Life, and Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, for which she won a Pulitzer Prize. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Annie Dillard is my guest. Is it ever hard for you to figure out what to write about?
Oh, it's impossible. I can't ever figure out what to write about. I just spent... my last idea was in 1977 when I had an idea for a short story that I've just finally enlarged a bit. I can't think of ideas.
That's a problem for a writer.
Many writers seem to have book after book just back there waiting in mind, but I sure don't.
Well, how do you try to get inspiration when you're looking for an idea?
Well, I just read and read. And try to pay attention to the world and try to pay attention to what I love about the world that other people don't seem to love or notice. But none of that works. I don't know. Every little book I've written seems to have had a different genesis, and there's nothing to be learned from it. I have no idea in the world how to get ideas. I read all of Boccaccio one time thinking, well, I will find one of these stories and do something with it. And it didn't do anything for me at all. I have no idea.
You know, one of your books, The Writing Life, is about the process of writing.
Yeah.
Was that during a period when you didn't know what to write about, so you figured you might as well write about writing itself?
What it was, purely, was working myself up, womping myself up to write The Living, which I knew was going to be an enormous effort. And it was a sort of private act of dedication, which I wish I'd kept private. I'm very sorry I published that book.
What?
Oh, it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I was going to work myself into a froth about how difficult and time-consuming this was going to be, I could have done that in my closet without going public with my little miseries. It's a funny book. It's funny as all get out. But other than that, I wish I'd kept it to myself.
How personal do you feel comfortable getting in your own writing? How far do you feel you go in revealing yourself?
Those are very different questions. I've never written personally at all, and yet people think that I do only because by writing about the world with such apparent, what they call, intensity, you reveal a lot. You know, if you talk to somebody about your parents or your childhood or something, you don't really get to know that other person, nor that other person get to know you so well as if you go to a museum together or a zoo. The thing is to react to the world, and that's how you reveal yourself. And apparently there's a lot of reactions to the world and therefore a lot of revealing. But I've never written about... my life, or what my dearest concerns are, not even in my memoir, not a bit.
Why not?
Well, it's just not what I'm about. There are all sorts of writers here, and I do what I do, and others do what they do. It's not a moral issue. It's just that's not what I do. That's not what I'm here to write about.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you won the Pulitzer Prize for Pilgrim at Tinker Creek?
I must have been 30. Or just about to turn 30. I guess I was 29. I started the book when I was 27.
Now, was that an ambition for you? Were you the kind of writer who felt, I'm going to prove that I could do it. I'm going to get that award?
Not in the least. I was in an academic setting. I was leading a life of essentially reading poetry and theology exclusively. I thought it would be wonderful to be published. That was certainly my highest ambition.
But winning the award wasn't a big deal?
at the time, it seemed to come after so much fuss and so many very disturbing trips to New York and the introduction, my introduction to a world that I didn't know existed, that it just seemed like one more thing to be dealt with. And I heard so much nonsense in connection with it. People called me, the press called me, I guess, and said, not my publisher, I mean the newspaper world called me and said, what are you doing right now as you hear that you have won the Pulitzer Prize? And I said, I'm washing spinach. And they said, don't you know that this means you need never wash spinach again? And I thought and probably said, sure I do. I don't like sand in my spinach. And I've been washing spinach ever since, and I think about it ever since. Did they think I was going to go hire a maid? I love to cook.
You mentioned these disturbing trips to New York. What kind of trips? Why were they disturbing?
There was a whole world full of people out there that thought that one wrote in order to move to Manhattan, in order to make a literary name for oneself, in order to get a table at Elaine's. All sorts of things that I'd never heard of in my life. I was living very purely with academic people who were reading the 19th century, essentially. And I was just utterly shocked. I'd been living there for 12 years in a wonderful, beautiful campus in Virginia, and I didn't know that this world existed, and was horrified. And I was young enough that when people misunderstood my motives, it upset me. But I'm coming up 47, but I don't care about those things now at all. I've completely come to terms with it. I found the Pulitzer Prize very useful for renting houses. unsurpassed for renting houses. Suddenly you don't need a security deposit. Suddenly everybody wants to have you there. And it's wonderful for that. And it's very nice for your publisher who's believed in you also. It's very nice.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Annie Dillard, and her new book is her first novel, and it's called The Living. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.